back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Raley, here on Redbox Media. And here we are, kids, episode 151. We've broken the 150 mark. And to mark this auspicious occasion, I've sat down with my friend Katie Heil. And so if you hear weird sounds in the background, we're at Katie's kitchen table and someone's mowing the yard all of a sudden. So like I always say, this is radio without a net. And Katie, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm really good. So Katie is the founder of, am I saying this right, Tatanga Bomoy?
Yes.
Okay. So which means what?
It means build our future in Lingala.
In Lingala.
Yes.
And Lingala is a language in the Congo, right?
Yes.
So Katie has founded this project called Tatanga Bomoy, build our future in it. Well, I'll let you tell it. So basically, let me tell you what I think it is, based on what I've heard you say and what Karen's told me and stuff, mm-hmm. is that you help women in the Congo use these beautiful fabrics that they have as kind of part of their culture to make products that are, good for the market in America and the West, and then basically like share the profits with them. Is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely what we do. So the project, the whole idea came from my local friend, Mama Arroyo. So I had gone to volunteer in the Democratic Republic of Congo after grad school in 2010, and I spent 1 year there as a volunteer with the Kenosian Daughters of Charity. And so through their small ministry, I guess, for volunteers, it's an Italian organization, they had a number of volunteers would come. Sometimes there'd be three of us, sometimes 10. And so we'd live within this community in northeastern Congo. It was in a village called Aru in the Ituri district. And so I had spent 1 year there as a volunteer working in like a bakery, an internet cafe, teaching English.
How big is this place? It's an internet cafe. So.
Well, yeah. Sometimes there's internet. Usually there wasn't. But Aru itself is about 25,000 people.
Oh, okay. So this is that's six times bigger than the town I grew up in Missouri.
Yeah. It's pretty spread out, but it's growing, and it's near the border of Uganda, and so there's a lot of trade, and it's easy to transport there, so the city's growing.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. So I had spent that year there as a volunteer, and then just as I was about to leave, my local friend, Mama Arroyo, had come and asked for $1,000 to build a home for her family. And so instead of, giving her the money, I asked her to make 25 handbags from the local Congolese material, the batik material. Mm-hmm. And I took those back and sold the handbags to friends and family and then returned the profits to her. And so just like her backstory, she was the sewing teacher at the all-girls high school. And she so she, like that year I got to know her because she made, skirts and shirts for all the volunteers from the fabrics and stuff. So I sent her back the profits, and then that kind of gave the two of us the idea, after I had, returned to Nebraska, where I'm from, to continue this project or this idea. And so the following December, for Christmas, I had her and four other women make 100 handbags that I sold at like church events or craft fairs, community events, the winter of 2012. And so we did that 2013, and then I went back with my friend Karen, who's from Denver, and she was also a volunteer in Congo. So she and I went back in 2014, and that's when we kind of set up and organized the first ever artisan cooperative in this town in Aru. And so we had about 8 to 10 women who committed at that point to be part of our cooperative.
Nice. So it's an artisan cooperative.
Yes.
That's a great word. I like that. That's a artisan cooperative. So is this, how is the setup? I mean, do the women share in the profits or you pay them per piece?
Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, like for the first, because 2014 is when we really kind of got organized. So for the past 2 years, the women, I pay them like per piece. And so with every product that they make, I have sent them down like a little tag that they sew on that product and they sign their name.
Oh,
and
nice.
So everyone who buys, you know, the handbag, we do handbags and headbands, neckties, bow ties, aprons. So each product that the women make is signed by them. So we're able to kind of control, you know, what each woman earns. But with that, the women also, in 2015, when I went back, we had a business training. And then we also started to rent a couple locations in the village for the women to work together.
Hmm. Oh, I thought they were all working from home.
No. So that was a big lesson that we learned through the business training. So yeah. When we were there last, it was February, and it was a week-long training. And so what we did with the women is we worked on budgeting and savings. And so it just seemed that like all of the women or the young girls in Congo, when they finished their secondary school, their technical skills in sewing, each of them had the idea to purchase a sewing machine and set up shop from home. Mm-hmm. But what you have every year then is 50 young women who are finishing secondary school, all wanting to buy a sewing machine that most of them can't afford or that they have to save and work for about 3 to 4 years just to buy.
Oh, wow.
And then they're all working at home, and then they're just competing with, you know, among each other for orders by the local people.
Oh.
Yeah, so once we kind of did the math with them and they realized that they were losing money instead of, you know, making more of a profit, because they also weren't taking into consideration the costs, you know, of having the sewing machine themselves, of the upkeep of that, you know, paying just little things like paying the cell phone minutes to call their customers, or the plastic bag that they would have to buy to put their product in, you know, to give the customer. So like all of these things started adding up, and when they realized that they could make more money individually if they would pool their resources together and share the costs, that's, you know, what we came to at the conclusion of the training, was that these women would put a little bit of money in each month to rent a shared workspace so that they could bring, you know, their sewing machines. And then our social enterprise here, I had done some fundraising and we purchased an electric sewing machine for them to use, and a solar panel and different things to kind of set up their shop in Congo. So
you're really, in addition to giving them something to do and giving them access to the American market, you're really kind of taking something that our civilization is good at, which is kind of business and efficiency and small business. It's kind of the engine of our economy. And you're taking those insights that maybe wouldn't occur to them in their culture, and then teaching them how to do that.
Right. Yeah, and it's taking the skills too that they have, because if you think about Africa and you walk down the streets, you know, of any large city or even small town in Africa, you're going to see more entrepreneurs in Africa than you'll see in the United States.
Really?
Just because, you know, they have like the idea of sustainability, right? Mm-hmm. And we get sustainable farmers where each family has their plot of land, they grow crops, and then they take it to market, you know? So even though you'll have like dozens of women all selling the same, you know, product, they're all entrepreneurs, you know?
Wow.
So it's taking the skills that they have, and it's just making it more efficient, you know?
So it seems like it's a good fit. They have an entrepreneurial society.
Oh, yeah.
And we have an entrepreneurial society.
Mm-hmm.
And we're taking what we've learned about how to expand an enterprise and make it more than just a one person doing something or a family doing something, and then sharing that with them in some
way. Right, yeah, and it's working a lot on quality, because we talked about also in the business training the idea of comparative advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have all of these, you know, as I mentioned before, these 50 young girls graduating secondary school, high school, all wanting to sew.
And they all learn how to sew?
And they all learn how to sew. I mean, it's just one of their options that they choose, you know. So most young women will either go the track of sewing or, you know, teaching. Or healthcare, perhaps.
So now this fabric is sewing and fabric and all the above just a part of this culture?
Oh yeah.
Because they already have this fabric is kind of like existing, and then you're saying that sewing is a major thing that people choose to study in school, which that's not, you know, I've never heard of that before.
Right. Yeah. No. It's especially in Congo, you know, they take such like love and pride in you know, their clothing, mm-hmm. especially for, you know, national holidays or church events.
And they're just like the most brightly colored, beautiful things you've ever seen. Yeah,
it's beautiful.
So, and I'm assuming you can see some of this stuff at, what's your website?
Yeah, the website is www.africanartisans.org.
So at www.africanartisans.org, mm-hmm. and you can see some of this beautiful fabric, and you can see the products that you guys make.
Yes.
With them. Well, that's cool. That's really cool. I love this kind of stuff. I have a friend that has a project called Haiti Made.
Okay.
And they do different products, like leather sleeves for coffee cups, mm-hmm. and different things like that. And they're doing a really similar thing with Haiti. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine used to have a guitar strap business that he worked with artisans in both Haiti and in Belize.
Oh, wow.
And it's just, it's funny. It's interesting how Americans, when they travel, they'll see something like, oh, hey, you're doing this.
Right.
People would love these. Mm-hmm. Let's find a way to get these in their hands and help you.
Yeah, so. Definitely. And marketing is just a huge part of it, you know, because we're not just selling a product, but we're mm-hmm. selling, you know, a story. And mm-hmm. and that matters to the artisans, you know, who are making, you know, these beautiful items.
All right. So when we get back, I want to talk about just about what this means on an individual level to these people and what life is like in the Congo and why this is so important, what you're doing. So, okay.
Perfect.
All right, so let's go off to the break, and when we get back, we'll dive into that. You're listening to The Counter Position. Thanks for coming out.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Raley, and we are here with Katie Heil of Tatanga Bomoi, and we're talking about social entrepreneurship, interaction between cultures, and you know, I guess maybe a dialogue between cultures where one person's strengths can be shared with another person's strengths, and everyone can prosper in the meantime. So Katie, what is life like in Congo, and what does it mean for one of these women mm-hmm. to be able to make the bags and make the kind of money that they can make working with you, and more if it gets bigger?
Sure. I think, like, right when you first said, you know, like, what is life like in Congo, and the whole first year that I spent there, and then each time that I've gone back, I have never in my life seen or experienced, I guess, so much joy and suffering at the same time. You know, like, they deal with, you know, setbacks every day, and it could be something as simple as, you know, they're riding their bike and, like, they have a flat tire, or it could be so much more, where they don't have enough food to feed their family for the day, or someone has malaria and they don't have enough money mm-hmm. to get the medication, you know. So,
and a flat tire would be a loss of transportation.
Oh yeah.
And I'm sure that, you know, you have to come up with the money for the part to
right.
fix that, you know.
Yeah. And then that day, you know, if you're transporting, you know, food to the market to sell, mm-hmm. you're not going to make any money that day because you never got there, and you're probably not going to make money the next day because you're going to have to spend the time fixing, you know, your bike or whatever happened.
Wow.
So it's just, I mean, these things, like, constantly happening. And as an American, it was just, like, frustrating me, you know, because I mentioned earlier, too, I worked at an internet cafe. Mm-hmm. And so I would serve, like, Congolese clients who would come in, and the internet would be so slow. Mm-hmm. Or I would sign them up for a Gmail account or type this whole document or translate an email for them, and then we'd lose the internet, and everything would just be erased. And I would just get so frustrated, and they would have to tell me, you know, Katie, it's okay. Calm down. You know, it's Africa. It's like, no, but your email, you know, and we'd have to start all the way over. But it's just the way things life is there.
Yeah, we get used to, I mean, not maybe everywhere in America, but we get used to, you know, for the most part, we don't have rolling blackouts or whatever.
Right.
When you flip the switch, if you've paid the bill, mm-hmm. the lights come on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if cable goes down, there's whole websites like isitdown.com, I think you can like go to your place and put in like Comcast or whatever. You can like find, is the cable down? What's going on? You know, I mean, like if the internet goes down in your house when you're trying to watch Netflix,
right?
You just snap. Mm-hmm. And they're just like, yeah, that's just, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just how, yeah. So, so I guess what it means for the women and the families is a few things, because, well, three. So our mission statement is to connect, to serve, and to inspire. Mm-hmm. And so the first point, connecting, is what's most important, because the... like the whole idea, the whole reason, you know, I'm in this business and all the women in Congo are a part of it is because we're friends, you know, so it grew out of friendship. And to connect them and their products to initially my family and then my friends and then my friends of friends and then the wider market, you know, across the United States is really important because it's sharing like the history, the culture, and just the beauty of the country of Congo and the Congolese people with those here in the United States who buy their product. So definitely like connection. And then to serve is important as well because it's allowing these women to make these products and to get paid for it and then to provide for their family, you know. So a lot of them are using that money to send their children to school or, you know, to help their parents or to help their brothers and sisters finish school, paying for medical bills, saving up for the future, you know, going off to higher education. Like, we really want these women to be able to meet the needs of their family, but also to dream, you know, and to dream big, that if they want to go, you know, study additional sewing, you know, in a larger city in Congo, then they should do that. And that's what they can save their money for. And then the final point is to inspire. And that's just to get more people, you know, in the United States involved in what's happening in Africa, and especially in Congo, because the population of Congo is 72 million people.
Wow.
Right? Yeah, it's a huge country, and they have just been through so much, you know, historically with
colonization. And they've got, there's cultural, there's political upheaval there right now, isn't there?
Yeah, we're coming up to like a presidential election, and so the current president has been in power for his elected terms, but he's going to try to run again, which is not in their mandate, you know, the constitution. And so there's starting to be conflict with that. But thankfully, like where we're situated is on the opposite side of the country from the capital city. And so we don't have to deal too much with, I mean, there's of course politics in Aru, but it's not, I guess we just don't experience the intensity of that.
Yeah.
As they do in Kinshasa, in the capital.
And so, I think it's interesting because we as Americans, first, either we A, have no idea what's going on in Africa, or B, we think that every place in Africa is exactly the same. I mean, I saw a joke like on The Onion or something, like a joke article online where they said that professors and teachers have finally just given up and they're going to officially designate Africa a country.
Yes.
Because people just like, you know, in countries like Africa, it's like, no country, Africa is a continent. Mm-hmm. And you have everything from people getting eaten by sharks while they're surfing in South Africa and running vineyards and stuff to what we think of as, I don't know why, I grew up seeing the late night commercials of starving kids with flies on their face and you think, oh, well, that's Africa. And then I got into the coffee industry and I started seeing all this beautiful African coffee coming out.
Yeah.
And I met like an Ethiopian coffee farmer and I'm like, I thought everybody was like dead in Ethiopia. Everyone was just like falling down. No, that's not the case at all.
Yeah, in Ethiopia, they just had the first like metro rail set up in Africa. So that just started, I think, this year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So it's, so these cultures are very different. And there's everything from, like I had a pastor back in Missouri that was from Nigeria.
Oh, okay.
And he said he was a really strange story because he moved to Italy when he was for high school because his brother had moved there and he worked in that giant McDonald's with the marble floors and stuff in like downtown Rome.
Oh my.
And with the high school, and he ended up, he's Catholic, and he ended up with like a show on television, like a youth-based Catholic show, and he was this Nigerian Italian.
Uh-huh.
And But he said that when he got to Rome, everyone was like, you know, what's it like to see a lion?
Yeah.
He's like, I'm from the city. The first time I saw a lion was in the Rome Zoo. I have never seen a lion.
Yeah, Africa there, I mean, there's so, I mean, not only are there so many different, you know, languages and cultures and ethnicities, but it's, I think, like you said earlier, people just have, like, that stereotypical image of Africa, you know, where everyone is living in poverty, and that's just not the case, because they're also, like, the continent of Africa is home to some of, like, the fastest-growing economies in the world today, and Congo is one of them, so...
So, in Congo is, what is, like, the standard of living across the board in Congo? What is the average? I mean, are they... Is a grinding poverty like a real serious normal thing in Congo?
Yeah, in Congo it still is, because they had gone through what people refer to as like the Great War of Africa, and that happened in like the 90s, early 2000s. And so there's still, I mean, from that time period, about 5 million Congolese people have died. And granted, most of it wasn't, you know, as a direct result of conflict, but it resulted from like famine and poverty and malaria and different diseases.
Are we talking
that
about
spread
the,
because of it?
The Rwandan genocide?
No, but that did play a factor into what happened in Congo. Yeah.
So the Great War of Africa was something different than that.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm a moron when it comes to that. I don't know anything about Africa, as you can tell.
Yeah, no, I mean...
I could talk meaningfully about coffee from Africa, but that's it.
Well, that's... Yeah, Congo's got great coffee, so...
I've never had Congolese coffee.
It's really good.
Maybe we should... next time you go over there, maybe we should get a connection to some specialty coffee. We can get it. Maybe we could have it roasted here in Denver.
That'd be awesome.
And we could have them make coffee bags that you could reuse.
Yeah.
From the fabric.
Done. Yes.
Boom. That's, you heard it here. So next year when the Counterposition website is selling Counterposition/Tatonga Bomoy coffee, you'll know, or Calyx probably would do that.
That'd be great.
So it's, what were we talking about? I totally derailed you. Oh, about the Great War. Yeah. The African War. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was just, I mean, it dealt with like a change of power from the dictator who was in charge, I think, maybe close to like 30 years in DRC. And then there was, you know, an upheaval or like a coup. And it just, I mean, it's very complicated.
Right.
And a lot of like other countries also played a part in it, like Angola and Uganda. And it was, it's, that can be like a whole nother show.
All right. So suffice to say that that's something that we don't think about. I just now watched a TED Talk by Arthur Brooks, the head of the American Enterprise Institute. And he talked about how poverty has gotten better in our generation. 2 billion people that used to live under American dollar a day are not living that way anymore. And one of the five things that he listed was the rule of law. I mean, just having stability, political stability, is a kind of a presupposition to doing some business. So it seems like in a lot of these places, they don't have that all the time.
Right. Yeah. And it's, no, that's a really good point. Because a lot of, or some of the reasons why investors and businesses don't go into Congo is because of the political situation and the tension between like the different groups and like the political groups and whatnot. And so once a country, you know, achieves that, then it opens the door for businesses to come in.
All right, so we got a hard break to hit, and then when we get back, we're going to delve more into that. So we're with Katie Hiley, who's in the Counterposition. Things coming up.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to the Counterposition. I am your humble host, and Katie Heil has survived two full segments of being interviewed by me, so Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
That's good. All right. So sorry about the heartbreak. We got caught up in conversation and almost had to bail really fast. And you almost didn't get commercials. And without commercials, we can't keep this ball rolling. So it seems like we were just talking during the break about how there's things that, you know, there's all these people in poverty. And the default idea is, oh, we need to start a NGO or something, and we need to get a bunch of donations, and the richer countries need to give a bunch of money mm-hmm. to the poor. But if that doesn't land into some kind of infrastructural change or cultural learning and innovation, mm-hmm. Something different, mm-hmm. then it's just like handing someone something and they eat it and then they're hungry tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And it seems like what you're doing is you're modeling something and enabling something that even if, God forbid, a satellite fell on you tomorrow or something, mm-hmm. they would go, oh, well, great. Mm-hmm. They'd be looking for a new person to sell their bags in America, but they wouldn't know how to do a co-op.
Yeah.
So you're leaving something there. Does that make sense? Or?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I use that example. I don't use a satellite. I usually say a bus. But yeah, like if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, what's going to happen to the women in the cooperative? Mm-hmm. Well, our goal is to make them sustainable both globally and locally. So we do, you know, we have created this avenue for them to sell their products to the Western market, you know, and that's what I'm able to assist with. But what we also do is, in addition to all of that, we have through our business trainings, the fact that they're working together collectively and the workspace, you know, the shared workspace, is that they're able to pool their resources together to increase their profit. It by serving local customers, you know, and serving them well. So we go into, like, you know, what is customer service and how do you attract customers, you know, in your village to come to your store, you know, like why are they choosing to come to the cooperative instead of going to, you know, the woman down the street, which is what they've been doing for years. And so, yeah, like just kind of getting the women in the cooperative to be, you know, sustainable both in making products for the U.S. or Western markets, and then also for the local population.
Cool. So they're learning a viable skill to where even if they went back to working on their own, they still like, oh, I learned how to differentiate myself or how to. And it's funny because in a lot of cultures, things are kind of set how they're supposed to be. And you don't want to differentiate.
Right.
You want to reliably make a such and such. Mm-hmm. And it's just like the ones. It's just as good as the other ones. Mm-hmm. It's the ones we've always made. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that if there's anything that we're good at in America, if you could call it good at it, is we say if it ain't, there's that old saying about if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Uh-huh. We say if it ain't broke, break it so that we can fix it and make it different.
Yes.
So we're constantly innovating.
And exactly, like that is the word of the year for the cooperative is to innovate, you know, because if we can take this like also in the direction of like men, right, and men's products, because that's what we're going to start moving our product line to, because, you know, a lot of different organizations do handbags, and handbags are being made, you know, every country in Africa, India, Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam. Everyone's got a handbag. But what we want to do is move into creating a fair trade product line for men. And so we started with neckties and bow ties. And those have been extremely popular in Denver, which is great.
Nice.
Yeah. But it's just getting the women to familiarize themselves with this new product, you know, because even like the men in Congo, they will not wear, you know, neckties or bow ties made of the local material, but they'll certainly, you know, buy, you know, neckties that we have, you know, as Americans probably donated in one of those bins that get shipped over to Africa.
Really?
And so the men will, you know, wear those ties.
But they won't wear the local stuff.
No, very rarely, but they're going to start, so. Yeah, at least in Aru, they will.
Well, that's it, because you can kind of create. Now, in addition to innovation, we're exporting another thing that we do in America, which is fashion.
Yes.
I mean, actually, like, dressing differently than we used to in a way that looks different, and people go, hey, that guy is different, you know? That's interesting.
Yeah.
We think of these as like maybe not strengths in our culture, things that distract us from culture or something.
Right. Yeah. No, it's really cool because when I was there just last spring, we did a photo shoot with a couple of my guy friends in the village, and they had worn the bow tie and the necktie, and they just loved it. And so, and even after that happened, I had a few other men from the village, you know, come up and want a bow tie and a necktie that was made from the local Congolese material. So these women buy, you know, filling orders that I place for them, you know, for U.S. markets. They're also like creating that, you know, new fashion, I guess, or a trend within their, you know, local village. So
now, it's funny. I'm a serial entrepreneur myself. So an innovation is like, I mean, actually pulling the trigger on something is something I'm not very good on, but innovating, coming up with ideas. Like I hear you talking about this, and I'm like, my first thought was, okay, what do they do in Congo in that area? Well, because we're talking about coffee. What else do they do that is besides fabric and stuff? And it's like, okay, I don't know, maybe, do they do cacao?
No, not in, not where in that part. Located for
I was thinking maybe like, you know, we could take some kind of natural thing that they make that's like, you know, cocoa butter or something like that. Or sometimes something you can make like an actual, like you make a two or three products for like, you know, and then put them all together in a bag with that and then sell the whole kit or something. And then there's like a little insert for like all the other stuff you have or something. You
know? That would be cool. And one thing that I think we could use natural resources for would be soap. You know,
there you go.
Yeah, because they have lots of like eucalyptus trees.
There you go.
Yeah, so there's like a lot that can be done with that too.
See, I think that there's, and then if you teach them, now you're teaching them even a further innovation where you're like, you collaborate locally and there's a eucalyptus guy can make some living, the soap maker can make a living, then you create this cool little bag that the soap goes in, it's wrapped in paper, then put in this little bag, and everyone is like contributing to it, and they're all now, because the three things that came together are more than the sum of the parts, and then they all do well, you know?
A lot
of people think very, I mean, a lot of people in America think very, because I'm doing what I'm doing.
Linear, yeah.
Just very, and just they don't think about collaboration.
Right.
You know, I had the hardest time getting coffee house owners in one small town in California to not think of everyone else with an espresso machine as a competition.
Right.
When Starbucks was taking 90% of the pie, and I tried to get them to play together in a group of independents, and it was like pulling teeth. They just didn't want to do it.
And it's just, and they're not going to unless they see the benefit, you know, but helping them realize it on their own is what's going to take it to the next level, I think.
Another thing you can do is, if you're making neckties, making sure that you make extra long neckties.
Oh, yeah.
For men of substance like myself, because, you know, it's kind of hard to find decent, cool neckties that go all the way down to where they're supposed to go when you've got a little something in the way out front, you know. You know, bellies of the world unite. Well, see, I think that's pretty cool. It's, how to say it? It's like it's taking something that we do and we understand and then taking it someplace else and marrying it with a dialogue to what they're doing in a way that's congruent with their culture. You're not just doing ideological colonialism. You're not setting up a sweatshop and having them create iPhone cases out of wood that they don't even normally cut down because they're like sacred trees or something. I mean, you're not doing that. You're doing something ergonomic to their culture.
And with that too, like it's very cooperative in the sense that we're not just going to be working with women. You know, I'm going back this year to start a second cooperative that's for the men. You know, because so many, I feel that and you see it on social media too, that there's just a, that Americans or Westerners have a very negative perception of African men. Mm-hmm. You know, like they're the ones behind conflict, or they're the mm-hmm. ones not providing for their family, or let's empower a woman because she serves her family better than a man does. Mm-hmm. You know, and I just, I mean, maybe there's some truth to that, but the, like, the mother and the father are both responsible for the upbringing of their children and raising their family. Mm-hmm. And so we want to empower both, like, the mother and the father.
What do the fathers normally do? What is their work there?
It is so hard. There's no, like, there's just very little economic opportunity for them to be involved mm-hmm. in. You know, because when I was there as a volunteer, there, like, I walked past this one road, you know, several times a day mm-hmm. for an entire year. And it was just a group of guys, like young men, standing there, you know, smoking and intimidating me every time I walked past them. You know, but individually, they were so kind. And we were good friends. But it's just you get them together, and all they just have nothing. They have nothing to do but to stand there, talk, and smoke. You know, they're maybe some of them are, you know, taxi drivers. But how many people, you know, take a moto taxi in this little village in Africa? Right. Not many. I think I've like taken it like twice.
So, is there what's the co-op you're going to start for men? What are they
going to
make?
Yeah, good. So they're going to complement what the women are making by making tie clips and money clips. And
awesome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like metal or wood?
Yes.
Or?
Yeah. So we're like, Aru is located pretty close to a gold mine that's in Congo, and it's one of the largest in sub-Saharan Africa. So they produce a lot of scrap materials, including like stainless steel and copper and brass and different metals. And so we're going to purchase those scraps from the leftover from the gold mine and hopefully hire a local artisan to train a group of men how to make these money clips and tie clips.
All right. So, all right. Well, let's go to the break one last time. When we come back, we're going to I want to talk to you about how this has affected you personally. So you're listening to The Counter Position. I'm your host, Andrew Wade.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Raley, here on Redbox Media. All right, the final lap, segment four. Okay, so what in the world does a white girl from Lincoln, Nebraska get out of like building your life around helping people? in some Congolese village. Yes. What has this been for you? How did you get into it? How did you decide? And what is this for you?
Right. My first, I guess, experience or encounter, you know, really serving another family was when I was in Lincoln, and it was high school. And I, of course, like junior high, you know, worked with my grandparents at the soup kitchen and did, you know, a few things on the weekends here and there. But I remember when I was a sophomore in high school, I met a woman from Afghanistan, and she had just arrived as a refugee with her 6 children, and her husband had been killed by the Taliban because he was a police officer.
Oh, God.
And so, yeah, so meeting them, and she noted they didn't speak English. They just got, you know, dropped off at the airport in Lincoln, Nebraska, which I'm sure they had never heard of until they landed there. And so just like...
Or even Nebraska.
Yeah, exactly. Like... Exactly. Yeah, so just, you know, meeting her and the very obviously like small conversations that we were able to have with one another over, you know, the following several months that I would visit the family and just kind of help out with setting up the kitchen and, you know, teaching the kids English, little things like that. It just really, it touched me that it was her kindness, it was their humility, it was everything that that family had been through, but that they still like had such open arms, you know, for being in a new country. And, you know, we're so thankful for everything that, you know, that everyone did for them. But it was a beautiful thing. Like, it was a beautiful relationship. And so that really got me interested in working with refugees, which is what I've, you know, had basically done ever since. So it's, you know, I studied international studies and for my undergrad and then my master's in diplomacy and international relations, focusing on refugees and development.
Wow.
And so, yeah, so I thought, like, after grad school ended, I needed, you know, that experience so that I could get the job with the United Nations or Catholic Relief Services, working in one of their posts, or international posts. And so I hadn't had that international experience yet, and so that's why initially I went to volunteer in Congo with that Italian organization. But it changed everything, you know, after I arrived there, because I went with the intention that it would help me on my resume. And of course, like, I wanted to serve and it was my passion and I loved it and I loved Africa ever since I can remember. But, you know, starting a business and an artisan cooperative, not part of the plan. Like, I had no intention of doing that. It's just happened to me, and it happened because of friendship, you know. If my friend in Congo, Mama Arroyo, if she hadn't asked me that week before I left for that $1,000, none of this would have ever happened, ever.
So it's like this, when you open yourself up to relationship with maybe someone very different than you, then an encounter can happen, and then some kind of a provocation, something as simple as, hey, do you have $1,000? And you're like, well, no, but maybe we could do something. And you don't, and if you just stop right there, like, hit pause, and you're like, so are you guys starting a business? It's going to change. Well, you're like, I'm just going to sell these bags so she can have this because I care about her. You know, it's a, I think some of the most beautiful and the purest things like that happen by quote unquote accident.
Yeah.
In a sense that they just emerge.
Right.
Through encounter, through personal encounter like that. So now you work with refugees now as a day job, right?
Yes. Yeah, I do.
And what is that about? Where are they from?
Yeah, so I work at the Colorado African Organization in Denver, and I'm the manager of education. So I teach English and then recruit volunteer ESL teachers who provide, it's 2 hours of English Monday through Thursday. And then I also run the citizenship program. So, like, the majority of, I guess, our students, both for English and citizenship, they've come here as refugees, as immigrants, they've, you know, received the lottery visa, and so, or they're married to, like, a U.S. citizen, and they come, and they're, you know, needing to learn English. But I would say a pretty significant amount of are refugees. And they're from everywhere, like African countries. They're from Burma, Bhutan, Morocco, Russia, Turkey.
Wow.
All over the Middle East. Yeah.
So this is, you have a, at the risk of derailing the conversation, you've got a pretty serious insight into this current refugee crisis then, and what it means for, I mean, I did a whole show basically saying that we should take a bunch of refugees in, and if, and bad stuff is probably going to happen, but because, yeah, this, but just all the arguments pro and con on that, and I'm saying that we should love, and if we suffer for the sake of love, then that's fine. But then you see, like, the situation in Germany, where you have this many kind of young Muslim men with nothing to do that come into this country from these, and then you see these, the way that they interact with, like, women at a in, when we had those sexual attacks at New Year's Eve and all that, where they just, like, well, they're walking around by themselves.
Yeah.
And you're like, well.
And as if that doesn't happen all the time in New York, you know, like, cities across the United States.
So what do you, so what's your take on the American situation and refugees with that? Or is it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously, I completely support that the United States should take as many refugees as we can, because at the end of the day, they're, you know, they're families, they're young men, women, and children who desperately just want to live. You know, they want what we want, like a roof over their head, food to eat, a school to send their children to, and just providing those all. It's just, like, as Christians, that's what we're called to do. So I would never contradict that.
And I think that the important thing would be to look to people like you and the different people that have this firsthand insight of the refugee experience and go, okay, great. There's taking them in and there's taking them in. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? What do they need when they get here? Mm-hmm. How do you help them, you know, assimilate in a sense that they can handle our culture and our culture can handle them? I mean, I think that the problem with the refugee crisis in Europe is you just have all these people that just got, that just came there and just got dumped there, and they're not being encountered, they're not being engaged with in any way.
Yes, yeah.
But the numbers are overwhelming, though, so I understand, you know. I had you sitting here, so I thought I'd ask you about this. This is a topic that comes up on the show.
Right. From time. I would be happy to sit down like another time because there's so much to talk about refugees.
We should talk about that next time. Mm-hmm. So, how has this played out like in your life and in your spiritual life and the whole idea? I mean, it's pretty funny. It's like Americans, we just don't know what to do with the poor.
Right.
It's like you just kind of out of guilt, you hand them a buck at the corner, or maybe you volunteer at a soup kitchen. Mm-hmm. But when we're faced with Africa or something, or some like systemic poverty someplace, we're just like, we don't know what to do.
Right. So with that, I'm just going to read a quick line from Joy of the Gospel that really inspires me and, you know, helps with the reasons, you know, why I do what I do, or explain it best. Mm-hmm. So it is through free, creative, participatory, and mutually supportive labor that human beings express and enhance the dignity of their lives. A just wage enables them to have adequate access to all other goods which are destined for our common use. And I think that this is really important because it's not... It's, you know, handouts versus development, you know.
Absolutely.
So rather than just giving people, you know, what helps them go from day to day, like no one wants to live, it's just like paycheck to paycheck, you know, we don't desire to live that way.
And we're not built to live that way.
Right, yeah. And so just providing these opportunities for these men and women who are my friends in Congo I don't know, hard to put into words, I guess, but I love what I do.
But it's, I mean, I guess the point that you raise is that it's not, in a sense, charity.
No.
Because you have a relationship with these people. Mm-hmm. This was launched in friendship. It's sustained in friendship. Mm-hmm. And this entire thing is an embodiment and an extension of friendship.
Right. Yes.
You got involved. You got in the middle of it. You built relationship.
Yes. That is why I do what I do. Because they're my friends.
Nice. Well, it's like Mother Teresa. They said, she one time told this reporter, she said, it's easy. I mean, what's your secret? He said, oh, it's easy. It's just that I love Jesus so much. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, okay, well, that sounds so trite. And he goes, yeah, but I can't help but see my beloved in the poor.
Yeah.
It's this person. I see this person with his name, that guy with this particular wound and this particular need. Mm-hmm. I see him and I see Christ in him because he's a person, you know? And I think that that's something we miss.
Yeah.
You know? All right. So AfricanArtisans.org.
Yes. Yeah. And we're having a fundraising campaign right now. Well, I guess for the next 9 days.
Okay.
So, and that's, it's on Start Some Good website. It's a crowdfunding site.
Okay.
And so if you just go to Start Some Good, the title of our campaign is Connecting Congolese Artisans to Global Consumers.
Okay, so startsomegood.org?
Yeah, .org, I think, yeah.
Just Google Start Some Good, look for Connecting African Artisans, africanartisans.org. Katie Howell, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, yeah.
All right, let's pull the plug and pop the cork on another episode of The Counterposition. Thanks for coming out, kids.